Welcome to Asimov's Spotlight. Here now, another story selected from the pages of Asimov's science fiction magazine.
All in Green Went My Love Riding by Megan Arkenberg. Read by Danny Daly. All of this happened that summer we played the love games. It was a wet year, sullen and quiet, and even at the time things felt not quite real, or like they were happening on the other side of a spotted glass. Shrouds of fog blew up off the lake, hiding the hills and muddying the ever-present smells of limestone and pine. It wasn't only pines at Hunger Lake. There were hemlocks, too. Pale trees with thick, curving trunks, like ribcages picked bare, like the skeletons of dragons some clever knight had trapped and left to rot. That summer was too cold for exploring, however. Too cold for anything but the hour in the afternoon when Miss Olwen, the gymnastics and riding teacher, would herd us all to the main lawn for our exercise. And after that we went running back inside for reading and sketching in the parlor. The girls who could play took turns on the out-of-tune piano, whose teak case was carved with naked, legless nymphs emerging from oversized flowers. One evening, Miss Darwin dragged us down to the lake to catch a bucket of sluggish frogs, which we dissected in the greenhouse behind the red dormitory. But by the last week of June, we were bored to tears. Perhaps we went a little bit mad. None of us could agree afterward whose idea it had been to make love to the girls in the gray dormitory. We had barely registered their existence during the school year. But now, as interminable June shaded into insufferable July on the Bismarck Cola calendar above Bridget's bed, we began to perk up our ears and twist our necks whenever our line passed theirs in the corridor. A row of hounds, all catching the deer's scent. Nimue, who had the best penmanship, printed the names of all the gray dormitory girls on a deck of old St. Valentine cards and tossed the cards in a pillowcase. We took turns closing our eyes and drawing from the bag. I drew a fat little fairy boy with purple wings and the name Caitlin Rose written across his stomach. I tried to remember Caitlin. Yes, she was the freckled, muscular girl with a long braid of corn silk colored hair, whom I had seen down at the stables 3 or 4 times that spring. I was uncertain what the first step should be. Nimue told me that Leah, whose lover would be Sally Evangeline, was planning to leave a curl of her luxurious blue-black hair in an envelope on one of the reading tables in the library, the one beneath the northwest window, where Sally could be seen most afternoons turning the pages of an old novel. I decided to do the same. I tied up the plain brown lock with a loop of silver ribbon and folded in a poem about a man who lost himself in a forest, who died trying to follow the sound of a lady's hunting horn. Caitlin didn't have a hunting horn, but I knew she would understand that I was thinking about her riding. That morning, I left the envelope in the stable by a rack of brooms and shovels. It disappeared before lunch, and for a day or two, I worried it had been swept up and thrown away. Then one afternoon during our hour of exercise, I saw Caitlin riding down the drive on Galahad, her handsome leather-red gelding. There was a bit of silver ribbon fluttering out of a locket pinned to her breast. They talked in the village that summer about something that was terrorizing the sheep. Terrorizing was the word the shop girls used. Their voices always peaked on the first syllable, as if they were really thinking about ripping clothes. It was probably a wolf, Miss Darwin said, and she showed us a cast of teeth marks the constables had taken from an injured lamb. I asked if the lamb had died, but Miss Darwin didn't know. The shop girls said it wasn't a wolf. They whispered about other things they had seen. Dirty linens draped over a fence at the edge of the woods, an orange rind, a broken bottle, a face pressed against the postmaster's window late one evening, a flat, white face like a mask. That kind of talk always stopped when we came into the shop, but Bridget and Nimue and I heard enough to worry us, and we agreed to ask Miss Morrow individually if she could see about having the men who were making nightly rounds in the village take their watch out to Hunger Lake. Miss Morrow shook her large, stately head and told each of us the same thing. You know we aren't part of the village, she said. We take care of ourselves. But I'm certain you'll come straight to me if you see something strange, won't you, Margot? Yes, I said. Yes, said Bridget and Nimue. That was the second week of July. Bridget had written up a chart on her calendar. There were 7 weeks of summer left, after each of us had taken the first step and given the gray dormitory girls a hint of our admiration. Every week now, with some leeway in case we got demerits and lost our allowance, we would help one of the girls in the red dormitory buy a present for her beloved. On Fridays, we would pool our money in Leah's little mothball-y purse and walk down to the store by the post office. It was one of those shops that sold ladies' things, postcards and stationery, lace cuffs and collars, paste jewelry, blue and yellow bottles of perfume, and makeup and white cardboard cartons. Although the girls at Hunger Lake weren't allowed to wear this last. We still bought it, sometimes, and hid it behind our books, and only brought it out to play dress-up by candlelight when the lamps were switched off in our rooms. My turn fell quite early, in the third week of July. We browsed the shelves for almost an hour, and the others began to get cross with me. I wanted something with a horse on it. A horse or a hunting horn. But the shop was all flowers and bluebirds and cottages and kittens. At last, I settled on a bracelet of round porcelain beads, each of them painted like a violet or forget-me-not. I worried that it might be too small for Caitlin's wrist. I left the bracelet in the stable, in the same place where I'd left the poem in the lock of hair. It was gone before breakfast the next day. But I must have been right about it being too small, because I never saw Caitlin wearing it. Something terrible happened in the last week of July. The men who made their nightly rounds in the village found a girl dead. She had been walking along the fence at the edge of the woods, collecting the jammy, poisonous berries that you can grind up and rub over your throat and chest to give yourself a powerful singing voice. But the men hadn't even heard her screaming. It was an awful sight, they said. The pine needles were matted in clumps from the blood. Her left arm was missing, torn off like a paper doll's. We learned all of this from eavesdropping on the shop girls that Friday. We stood at one corner of the display, shuffling through a rack of silk scarves to help Janet pick out a gift for Kelly Renee. But the plump, pretty girl at the counter carried on the conversation like she didn't know we were there. I think it's some vagrant, she announced to her friend, who was arranging tubes of lipstick on a wooden rack. Ever since Mrs. Emery saw that face at her window, I've been convinced that's what it is. Some old pervert wandering around in the hills. Her friend shushed her, nodding at all of us in the corner. She had caught me staring. I don't care, said the pretty fat girl. I think the freaks can take care of themselves, don't you? That's assuming they're not the ones doing it in the first place. I didn't understand what she meant, exactly. But I understood enough. My fist tightened around a scarf printed with licorice-colored hounds. So hard, I felt the fabric start to tear. Janet had to pry it out of my hands. And even then, it wasn't until she started dabbing at my cheeks with it that I realized I had begun to cry. That night at dinner, Miss Olwyn stood in front of the teacher's table, her thick, tortoise-shell glasses resting on the end of her nose, and read out an announcement from Mrs. Morrow. It said that all outdoor privileges were revoked until further notice. The Red Dormitory girls smiled at each other. No more daily exercise! But at the Gray Dormitory table, I saw Caitlin frowning into her plate of bread pudding. Then Miss Olwyn cleared her throat, and Caitlin looked up. And something must have passed between them, because suddenly Caitlin was smiling too. I liked the way it looked on her. The following week, on the 1st of August, we began the next stage of the games. It was a race, said Leah, shaking out her blue-black curls, to see who could get kissed first. That was cheating. Leah had already met Sally Evangeline in the greenhouse behind the Red Dormitory and kissed her and touched her hair. We suspected that Leah had been keeping some of our money each week in that mothbally purse of hers, because when she finally bought Sally a present, it was a big, tulip-shaped bottle of perfume, bigger and lovelier than anything the rest of us had managed. In any case, when we told her she would have to be out of the running, she just smiled her luxurious watermelon candy smile and watched the rest of us scramble to catch up. We met with mixed success. Whether we were all being watched more closely that summer, teachers lurking around every corner, or the Gray Dormitory girls were unusually shy, or boredom and listlessness kept us in our separate wings, it felt suddenly that it would be a heroic task to even get one of our lovers alone. Janet hit on a remarkable string of luck, leaving some pencils in the pocket of our skirt on laundry day. She ran down to the basement to fetch them and found Kelly Renee in the same predicament, shuffling through a pile of calico and lace in search of some trading cards with pictures of cinema stars. And when they walked back to the dormitories, Janet aimed a kiss at an astonished Kelly's ear. Inadequate as that seemed to all involved, it looked like that would be the closest anyone came, until Bridget, of all people, waltzed back into the Red Dormitory after dinner one evening, blushing like a stove. What was it like? Janet capered, evidently not too displeased to be dethroned. Soft, Bridget said, and cold. She told me a bit more that night, curled at the edge of her bed after lights out, the green-eyed girls on the Bismarck Cola calendar smiling down at us like benevolent goddesses. She rambled on about Anna Claire's lips and teeth and hair, and I lay with my head pillowed on her shoulder and let my mind roam. It was all very well for Janet and Bridget, I thought, but I could never get Caitlin alone. Even when I saw her trotting Galahad up the drive, her hair coiled under her helmet and her green riding jacket buttoned against the cold, Miss Olwyn was always waiting somewhere nearby, watching the forest like a wary mare. In the midst of all this, the restriction on our outdoor privileges and the kisses, another girl was attacked in the village. Mrs. Morrow wouldn't tell us what happened, but we knew the girl wasn't killed. She didn't see what had hurt her, she told the watchmen. But they said it wasn't an animal. This was not something an animal would, or could, have done. Still think it could be the freaks? I overheard the shop girls asking each other one Friday, when we were once again gathered around the scarves and paste earrings and hollow papier-mâché pearls. Miss Darwin had escorted us into town, and she sat at the cafe across the street, reading and sipping something bitter from a white china cup. "Why not?" the plump girl quipped. "Who knows what they're hiding under those stuffy skirts?" The other girl giggled and swatted her arm, then whispered something else that made the both of them laugh until they were crying. They laughed and laughed, wiping their noses on their sleeves, until the pretty one caught me staring. "What's wrong with you lot, huh?" She drew herself up, like Miss Olwyn reading out an announcement, and her voice was abruptly cold. "Don't you have families to go back to over the summer? Or do they just not want you back?" "I don't know what you're talking about," I said, just as coldly. I felt suddenly wicked. "We can take care of ourselves. Do you think you can?" The color drained out of her rosy face. Without another word, she slammed the cash register closed and turned the key, and told her friend to draw the curtains. The store was closed for the day. In the third week of August, the doctor came to Hunger Lake. Mrs. Morrow practically glowed. She put on her best dress and pinned a pearl brooch in her hair, and when the black coach rolled up to the door, she ran out and kissed its occupant on both cheeks. He was quite a bit taller than her, and he rested his chin on the top of her head and called her Penny. He was the only one who ever did that. Not even Mrs. Montgomery, the deputy head, called her anything but Mrs. Morrow. I think someone said the doctor was her father, although I can't imagine Mrs. Morrow ever having been a little girl. In any case, in spite of how kind the doctor was to Mrs. Morrow, and to all of us, I hated medical inspection. They made us go into a small, cold room off the dining hall and had us undress. And then they pricked and prodded us to test our blood and our reflexes, they said. There was a new nurse this time, too. New nurses were the worst. They always gasped and made strange faces. After measuring my heart rate and my blood pressure and my reflexes, testing my vision and my teeth, the doctor tucked his tools back into his big leather case and drew his chair closer to the examination table. "All perfect," he said. "Heart and nerves are regular as an oiled watch, and your eyes and teeth are keen as any girl's I've met. How are your legs, my dear?" "Fine," I said, looking down at them. They were beautiful as ever, slender and straight. The hooves gleamed like obsidian mirrors. I could almost see my face reflected, my own eyes peering back at me from across a great distance. The doctor took one in his hand, settling into his chair, and pressed his thumb against the pad. "Good," he murmured. He ran a finger along the edge. "Hard and sharp, too. Never be afraid to use them, Margot. Do you understand?" I nodded. "Run if you can, if you're ever in trouble. But kick if you must. You've heard that there's something frightful in the woods?" "Yes," I said. He released my leg. The nurse gestured for me to hop off the table, but I closed my fingers over the edge, swinging my feet. "Is it a vagrant?" I asked the doctor. "Or do you think it's one of us?"
"One of you?"
His nearly invisible eyebrows flew up to his hairline.
"Why would you ask that?"
"The girls in the shop say so." The doctor frowned heavily, big creases opening at the corners of his mouth. He must have made some signal to the nurse, because she draped a thin, powder-blue blanket over my shoulders and stepped around to the other side of the curtain.
"Listen to me," the doctor said.
He rested his elbows on his knees, pressing his palms together.
"You ladies in the red dormitory are as gentle as can be. Those foul-minded shop girls are more likely to have done this than any of you."
I nodded and bit my lip, huddled in the rough blanket. I believed him, of course, about the girls in the red dormitory. But there was still a question I didn't know how to ask. The creases around his mouth deepened, and he patted me on the wrist.
"A very good eye is kept on this school," he said. "You will be protected, my dear. Just keep those hooves strong."
The nurse sent me out of the dining hall, my blouse neatly rebuttoned, my skirt smoothed and centered. But I didn't return to the dormitory. There was a secret space above the foyer, a narrow ledge in front of the big, drafty, leaded glass window that sparkled like a tray of marzipan fruits over the front door, and you could reach it with a bit of goat-footed shuffling from the second-floor landing. I curled up there, my forehead pressed against a lozenge of deep cobalt glass. I could see the front drive below me like an underwater world, the jays driving across the gravel like strange fish. Soon, the doctor's carriage rolled by, slow and clumsy as a turtle. I stayed there through dinner, knees and buttocks numbing, the eastern sky dimming and losing color on the other side of the window. Soon, I heard the clack of Mrs. Montgomery's smart Oxfords on the landing. She called my name and said there was a bit of bread and cold ham saved for me in the kitchen, but I called back that I wasn't hungry.
"In bed, then," she decreed.
"Yes, Mrs. Montgomery." But I didn't move from my tight snail-shell crouch. I must have fallen asleep. When I opened my eyes, it was dark. The stained glass window had gone black as rubber. After a moment, I realized what had awoken me. Something crunched along the gravel drive below. I blinked a few times and pressed my eye to the glass, squinting, trying to confirm what I thought I saw in the moonlight. It was Caitlin, dressed for riding. Galahad's reins looped around her wrist. Miss Olwen was nowhere to be seen. The window glass sat loosely. One panel in particular left a finger's breadth of space between the glass and the thick ribbon of lead that held it in place. I pulled it back and put my lips against the gap.
"Where are you going?"
Caitlin spun and stared up at the school, mouth agape. I flicked the glass panel back and forth until her eyes settled on the motion, and she crossed her arms.
"Is that you, Margot?"
I hadn't thought she would recognize my voice. My cheeks warmed, and I said, "Yes!" so loud and sharp it sounded like a tea kettle. My head suddenly felt very crowded. Bracelets and silver ribbon and locks of hair and poems about hunting horns and the vanilla smell of the perfume Leah bought for Sally Evangeline, and also what Bridget had said about Anna Claire's teeth. I didn't know if Caitlin could see me through the dark glass, but I felt her eyes on me like the doctor's reflex hammer, landing right between my shoulder blades.
"Don't worry," she said at last. "I've done it before. Gone riding at night. It's good for Galahad, and it lets me keep an eye on the grounds."
"We take care of ourselves," Mrs. Morrow had said.
But something wasn't right. I thought of Miss Olwen keeping wary guard all those afternoons. "I'll wake the teachers," I whispered. I couldn't have said where this sudden boldness came from, almost a wickedness. Like I directed at the girl in the shops.
"I'll call them and say, 'Don't, Margot.'"
Something changed about the way she stood. Her weight shifted all to her back leg. Now she could look up at the window without craning her neck. Her shoulders fell back, and when she spoke, her voice was no longer a whisper. "If you stay very quiet," she said, "I'll show you a secret. It has something to do with the attacks."
"Bluffing," I almost said.
But I knew she wasn't. The pure confidence of her stance, the clarion clearness of her voice, no trace of conspiratorial whisper. It meant knowledge, real knowledge. I withdrew my finger from the window, letting the glass click back into place. Then I was clambering down to the front drive, skirt flapping around my bare legs, heedless of how cold the night would be without my cardigan. Caitlin did not take my hand. She nodded to me, and her smile made my throat tighten like the drawstring on Leah's little purse. Then she led me silently along the riding trail that curved down toward the lake. It was very damp, the ground slick as butter under our feet, but the night air held still for once, no wind rattling through the pine needles. The moon was full and bright. We had gone maybe 3/4 of a mile when Caitlin stopped and looped Galahad's reins around the branch of a young pine that jutted across the path. "This way," she mouthed, nodding to a nearly invisible break in the trees. Perhaps it was a deer trail, or something even less substantial formed by the trickling of rainwater, a bit of earth swept almost clean of needles and pine cones. It would lead us away from the lake. Caitlin padded up the incline, careful to step on the border of the trail she'd uncovered, leaving no footprints on the shiny wash of mud. I followed as lightly as I was able, ducking beneath the boughs Caitlin gallantly swept aside. At last we reached the place. The camp. A triangular slab of limestone loomed out from the side of the hill, and the deer path ran right under it. We crept closer, and I saw that the rock sheltered a small stack of firewood, freshly and unevenly chopped. Farther inside, there was a ragged flannel blanket. I crawled back and found an enamel cup with a bit of sharp-smelling liquid stuck to the bottom, and something made of thin, glossy paper. I held it up to the moonlight and tossed it away in disgust. It was a dirty magazine, with a skinny, sleepy-looking girl on the cover. "He's always gone at this time of night," Caitlin said, kneeling on the cold blanket beside me. "This is when he goes to the village and peeps in women's windows. I saw him creeping down the trail once and had to hide me and Galahad behind a hemlock. He makes sure he isn't followed." I sat heavily, landing on a pine cone, which snapped like a gunshot in the silence. It was a comical sound, but I wasn't in a laughing mood. "He hurt that girl 2 weeks ago, I realized. "She said he covered her eyes so she couldn't see his face." Caitlin nodded, and I wrapped my arms around my knees. "What are we going to do?"
"Nothing," she said.
She raised herself to a crouch and brushed off her trousers. "The men on the watch will catch up with him eventually, and they'll make it so he never comes back here." I watched her crawl out from under the limestone slab. She felt around for something in the pine needles, picked it up, and came shuffling back. It was the dirty magazine. "What about the other girl?" I asked. "The one who was picking berries?" Caitlin tucked the magazine back into the folds of the blanket. Her long, corn silk hair flopped into her face, and she brushed it away with her paws. "That was real sad," she said softly. "That girl was a pretty singer already. She didn't need those berries." When we returned to the front drive, the moon was still round and clear, and sunlight was already stretching its honey fingers over the lake. I'd utterly lost track of the time. A family of blue jays started screaming from the lilac trees as we approached. Still, I couldn't make sense of how bright everything seemed until I realized that an arcade of lamplight was shining out of the dining hall. We had barely rounded the corner to the stables when Mrs. Montgomery came flying out the delivery door, her dark hair loose and bouncing on her shoulders.
"Margot! Caitlin Rose!"
She loped towards us and I almost flinched, but she didn't look angry. Her face went slack and soft with relief. "Go inside now," she said, "straight to the dining hall." And she snatched Galahad's reins from Caitlin's astonished fingers. We marched obediently into the dining room, not a word passing between us.
As soon as we stepped through the door and the rush of lights and warmth brought me to my senses, I opened my lips, but immediately a wiry arm grasped me across the chest. It was Janet, her eyes as puffy as pillows. She steered me to the long table in front of the hearth where the red dormitory girls huddled. Caitlin, I saw, had been snatched up by Miss Olwen, whose freckles stood out like flakes of rust on her white, white face.
Nimue is still missing, Janet said, tugging me down onto the chair between her and Bridget.
Across the table, Leah cried noisily and wound her hair between her fingers.
Mrs. Morrow and Miss Darwin have asked the men from the village to help them search the woods. We didn't know where any of you were. Nimue went out to meet Francis Jean at the boathouse, but Francis came back 3 hours ago and said Nimue had never shown up.
And Margot, Bridget said, taking my hand under the table, they found something. Miss Darwin and the villagers. It's an animal's den. There's a cave on the other side of the lake, not far from the sheep pastures, and it goes snaking back into the stone. I shook my head, pulling my hand away from hers.
That couldn't be right. A cave? An animal den?
The limestone overhang had been shallow, the marks of human habitation unmistakable, and Caitlin and I had seen no one.
Not a den, I said. A camp. It's some man, some vagrant who's been sneaking into town. We saw his firewood and his magazine.
No, it can't be. Bridget looked bewildered, her eyebrows almost touching over her long, slender nose.
It's certainly an animal's. They found bones and fur, and no trace of a fire.
Those weren't a man's teeth on the lamb bones, Janet said quietly. I had forgotten about the lamb, the plaster casing Miss Darwin had shown us that day in early July. Now I felt cold all over. My teeth started chattering, and Bridget stripped off her cardigan and wrapped it around my shoulders. We waited. The clock tolled 6, then 7. The day staff arrived, and Mrs. Montgomery sent them out to help with the search. Just after our breakfast of jam and untoasted bread, news came from Miss Darwin in the village. Some of the men had crawled to the edge of the burrow, and they found the murdered girl's arm. It was chewed to the bone in places, but scraps of sleeve still clung to it. And around the wrist was a bracelet of blue porcelain beads. The day passed without news of Nimue. The teachers wouldn't let us out of their sight. Sometime around noon, Mrs. Montgomery took us back to the dormitory to collect our books and drawing materials, and then we sat around the hearth in anxious pairs, reading poems or practicing life sketches. I posed for Janet, biting my lip to keep it from trembling. The gray dormitory girls didn't mingle with us. Miss Darwin, who returned frayed and wan from the village, set them solving equations out of their big orange chemistry books. Caitlin sat alone at one end of the long table, turning the pages very slowly and writing very little in her notebook. She chewed on her pencil. I tried not to stare at the marks her teeth left in the pale yellow wood. Dinner was porridge. Supper was sliced cheese on more cold bread. At sunset, Mrs. Montgomery ushered us back into our beds. She stood in the doorway until we were under the covers, then turned off the lights. None of us slept. We just lay there, in the uneasy dark. Sometime after midnight, a sound roused us. A sharp, weighted clack, like a breaking plate. Footsteps, I realized. Hooves on the tile roof. I sat up slowly. Janet and Bridget were already standing, pulling on skirts and cardigans. I held my finger to my lips and tiptoed to the window. About 2 stories below, Nimue crouched awkwardly
on a narrow stretch of roof, the steep gable that shielded the passage from the red dormitory to the greenhouse. She lay almost flat on the west side of the peak, evidently to avoid the attention of whoever patrolled the front drive. Her clothes were filthy, her sweater matted with mud. I couldn't hear her voice at such a distance, but the swing of her hand was unmistakable. "Follow me." In the room behind me, Janet had gathered up an armload of pillows. I dressed hastily, and Bridget and I followed Janet into the hall. It was darker than the moonlit bedroom, and perfectly still. We looked at Janet with the same question in our eyes, but she was already dragging herself up onto the radiator beneath the row of casement windows. She cracked the nearest window as far as it would open, then tossed one of the pillows onto the parlor roof below. She grinned over her shoulder at us. I offered my bravest salute, and she aimed her hooves and jumped. I went second, and Bridget brought up the rear. Once all three of us had reached the parlor roof, we repeated the pillow and leap procedure to descend to the veranda, then monkeyed our way down a lilac tree at one corner of the porch. Nimue was waiting for us on the recreation lawn. We followed her briskly into the woods until at last we had gone far enough to talk. "He caught me when I was halfway down to the boathouse," Nimue said all in a rush. She was leading us east, back to the front of the house and the lake, but under the shelter of the trees. Up close, I saw that there were needles in her hair and shining tear tracks on her cheeks. "I didn't mean to kick him so hard," she stammered, "but there was a snapping sound, and he stopped moving. I dragged him off the path and hit up a tree. I was so scared. I don't know what they'll do when they see what I've done." We stopped walking. She drew an electric torch from her pocket and switched it on. There, at the edge of the path, was a man's body, the arms flung out towards us, the legs still hidden in the needles and fallen branches. The face was scraggly bearded, the hair thin and greasy. It was clothed in muddy slacks and a filthy, once white shirt torn open at the waist. A pair of hoofprints shone on the white chest, one deep enough to glisten with blood. "Are you hurt?" Bridget asked softly. "Not much." Nimue put the electric torch on the ground and rolled up her sleeve, showing a black thumbprint bruise on the inside of her elbow. Bridget kissed it lightly. "It's fine, really. But please, you have to help me get rid of him." We set the torch on the body's stomach. Then we linked hands, me and Janet, Bridget and Nimue. We lifted the corpse across the low bier of our arms. It was unpleasantly heavy, like a sack of wet flour, and it stank. Carefully, we shuffled down the path, then over the pebbled beach at the edge of the lake. We waded to our hips and let the body go. There was no chance of returning to the school without being noticed, so we didn't try. We trudged wearily up the gravel drive, our wet skirts slapping against our legs, the mud-speckled beam of Nimue's torch dancing along the ground in front of us. Miss Olwen and a couple men from the village saw us approach and came running, Miss Olwen shouting in joy and dismay when she saw Nimue's dirty face. We stood for a moment as they ran to us, catching our breaths. I glanced for an instant at a window high in the gray dormitory, where a pair of golden eyes was watching us. They must have seen mine glinting in the electric torchlight, because they quickly turned away. The rest of the summer warmed. There were no further attacks on sheep or women. The villagers filled the burrow with rubble and burned some of the trees in front of it. And when that was done, our outdoor privileges were restored. We abandoned the love games with little fanfare. None of us had much success, really, and gifts and kisses were nothing compared to running and swimming and ball playing. There were no more thrilling sparks when we passed the gray dormitory girls in the corridor.
I saw Caitlin ride out on Galahad a few more evenings, unaccompanied by Miss Olwyn, but I didn't speak to her again. Although, I noticed she still wore the locket with my lock of hair inside. Not everything remained as it had been. Miss Olwyn left quite suddenly before the school year began, and Miss Montgomery took over our gymnastics lessons. She had us study fencing and archery, and even a little boxing, and by Christmas break she declared herself thoroughly pleased with our progress, with Nimue in particular. In some way we couldn't quite define, we had satisfied her expectations. And at the end of the next year, we, Bridget and Janet, Nimue and Leah and I, graduated from Hunger Lake. Mrs. Morrow found us quiet, out-of-the-way positions as teachers and governesses and game mistresses. A man from the government came by to swear us to secrecy, and then he shook our hands and congratulated us. We were the brave ones after all. We had learned how to protect ourselves. We had learned how to move through the world, even when it rejected us, even when it was cruel. But what about the others? What about Caitlin, Anna Claire, Sally Evangeline? We were taught to be vulnerable, yes, and to conquer our vulnerability. But what about the girls who were never taught to be dangerous? I wouldn't think of it now, that damp, dreamlike summer when we played the love games. Except, it's another cold summer, and my students are growing restless. I work with Mrs. Morrow's sister, who still spells her name the French way, teaching drawing and a bit of sculpture. Two of my girls snuck off into the hills the other day, and they found a vagrant's camp. It was a strange place. There was no fire, but there was a bed and blanket and the marks of a horse's hooves. And under the pillow, they found a lock of hair tied with a silver ribbon and a poem about a lover's hunting horn, which they have taken to reciting as they skip up and down the cold, echoing halls.
Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.